This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Excellent. All is well.
Fantastic. All right. For today, we are talking about a couple of articles about happiness. Now, the whole point of this podcast is to find happiness in the modern world by identifying different ways that we can fall into certain traps. And Dr. Lyle, you know, you've talked extensively about different things that hinder our happiness. So a new article actually just this year has been published about happiness. Now, previous myths about happiness say that happy people live longer. Well, and we kind of hear this all the time that, you know, stress may cause an early death and all these other types of myths. Well, two researchers named Bruce Heedy and Jong Se Yong out of the University of Melbourne, they have been questioning this wisdom of happiness's relationship to longevity. So what they did is they took data from two very large long-term panel studies conducted in both Germany and Australia, and they explored some anomalies in these happiness longevity studies. And so a couple of points about their research. There is a big role of health that is played in happiness. So people who are set to die younger for whatever reason than their counterparts are, they're going to be unhappier because they are suffering from poor health. And happy people live longer because they don't have the chronic conditions that shorten life. And so this was, the authors are sarcastically quoted in this article saying that unless we are to believe that happy people stay along by sheer willpower, and we know that Roy Baumeister's work on willpower says that we really don't have as much as we hope we do. But also personality needs to be factored into this equation. So there was one prior study that reported that it's actually that the happiest people died at younger ages, and their early deaths had nothing to do with happiness per se, but with the factors that led to their death. As it turned out, the happy people who died sooner were actually carefree and reckless as children. So the lower the personality trait of being lower in conscientiousness meant that they took fewer preventative measures, met an early death than their less cheerful but more careful health conscious people. Also meant that their cheerfulness and happiness was matched with smoking, drinking too much, driving too fast, and not complying with their doctor's orders and health treatments. Sure. So they didn't die because they were too happy, but because they failed to guard against the threats to their health. And you know, healthy people live longer, barring any random cause of death. And they're also healthy people live longer. And so they're also the ones left standing when the less healthy members of their generation die off. So any study of aging, no matter what the topic, there's going to be people dropping out of that population who lack the right stuff, the secret sauce that gets them to live longer. So they may have inherited unhealthy genes, made decisions that place them in harm's way, like, you know, rock climbing or skydiving or whatever it is, made them subjected to harsh early environments. But the authors state that, quote, because those whose health seriously declines also suffer a decline in life satisfaction, it may seriously bias results in favor of finding a positive link between life satisfaction and longevity if the last few years of life are included. The other issue that they raised is the possibility that the previously reported happiness and longevity relationship assumed what's called linearity. If this assumption is true, then happy 10-year-olds are supposed to become equally happy 90-year-olds. But from the review of the literature, the authors actually concluded that people with low levels of life satisfaction die young, but otherwise life satisfaction appears to be unrelated to longevity, and that there's no evidence that even very high life satisfaction or very happy individuals live longer than people who report average levels. So this is what the study actually tested. This was first tested in 1984. They had about 12,500 individuals, and they followed them on a yearly basis. And by that time, by the last wave of testing, the sample had grown to about 60,000 people. And then the Australian study, they began in 2001, and they had about 14,000 participants, and this grew to about 17,000. And people got lost because they died, but they took out as much as possible the role of selective survival of the happiest. So with these average scores, they corrected for the possibility that life satisfaction late life ratings can reflect changes due to ill health. So they actually eliminated ratings from people for the last 3 years of that person's life if that person had died. And then with the average scores, they then divided all the panel members into three groups: high lifetime, medium lifetime, and low lifetime life satisfaction. And so then they controlled for health, disability status, obesity, and a lot of socioeconomic measurements. Age was also used as the time duration variable. In other words, the older you are, the longer you have endured across time. And then they also controlled for behavioral choices like physical exercise, social network, smoking. They also included religious attendance, interestingly enough, because they thought that it was possibly due to the social support that people receive. And so with all those controls in place, then the authors were able to calculate the relative risks of dying for those three life satisfaction groups. And as they predicted, the relationship between happiness and longevity was nonlinear. So the evidence just is very strong that suggests that unhappy people die young, but across every bit of the rest of the distribution, happiness makes absolutely no difference to how long you live, to longevity.
Mm-hmm. Longevity, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. Longevity. God.
I understand. You once you get it in your head wrong, it spins around for a while. Yeah, this is a very interesting study. I just looked at this earlier today, and It was nice to see some clear thinking humans actually take on an obviously absurd concept and blow it to smithereens. So let's cast this net a little wider, even further than we have. Let's break this down. Let's not think like typical thick-headed individuals who are not interested in being critical, looking for the truth. Let's think like biologists, and let's think like psychologists, and let's think like, you know, essentially biochemists. Think like an evolutionary thinker. If you, for example, sprain your ankle, would we expect that the experience of the pain that goes with that would damage you? The answer is, of course not. The experience of the pain is a guidance system that's there to engineer behavior changes that are in your best interest. The fact that the behavior changes are being encouraged by pain is just one way to do things. You can encourage movement by making it pleasant, and you can discourage movements by making them painful. Either way, what you're going to do is you're incentivizing the organism to move in such a way that's optimum for its survival or its gene survival in the case of sex. Now, but in any event, we wouldn't expect that the qualitative experience of the signal would have any impact on the tissue of the organism, for God's sakes. And yet, it is not uncommon for people to think that if they have something terribly upsetting happen to them and they have their, quote, heart broken, that this is going to somehow do damage to their body. And similarly, people feel like if they're really happy, somehow that's the key to a long life, is that if you're happy and you have things going well, then that's healing for you somehow. This is ridiculous. Okay. The nervous system and its feeling states are simply guidance systems to tell you whether the circumstances you're in are good or bad for your gene survival and to what degree and in what way. Okay, so when you sprain your ankle, it doesn't hurt in your ear. It's the feelings are as specific as possible, but their nature, of course, it wouldn't make any sense for the signal, no matter how painful it is, to do any damage, for God's sakes. This is a little too sophisticated for most of the world. So, yeah, this was always an absurd concept. It's an absurd people thought that, oh, if you have terrible things happen to you emotionally, it causes you to have cancer. This is insane. It doesn't make any sense at all. Why would nature engineer you to have a feeling that would do you damage, for God's sakes? Okay. Now, we have to separate out that when you sprain your ankle, there's damage to the tissue. So the tissue is damaged, but the pain isn't what damaged you. It was the movement that was inconsistent with the stress tolerances of the organism. And therefore, damage was done, and now the organism must signal to you the nature of that damage and its extent. Okay. And so that therefore you can compute the further use of that tissue in its damaged state and the further damage that you will do to it. And you can compute that against a cost-benefit analysis of all the selection pressures that are taking place with you on that moment. So if you're running for your life from a predator and you sprain your ankle, oh, too bad. The feeling of pain is there, but you are fortunately have so much adrenaline that you can't feel the normal pain signal because the system is so incredibly focused on survival that it will go ahead and sacrifice damages that were done appropriately. Now, that adrenaline isn't magic. It's there to appropriately balance the actions, the decisions of the organism. Now, so this was a neat study because it basically said, of course, you know, being happy in life doesn't lengthen your life, and being miserable in your life doesn't truncate your life. What they're basically showing is that if you have a miserable life, one of the reasons you're miserable, you're having a miserable existence, is because you're falling apart and you're in serious frickin' physical discomfort because you're sick and you're dying. Okay, so once you control for that factor, the emotional component of a human's life has absolutely nothing to do with how long they live, just as we would expect. If we're an intelligent biologist that's using even a few neurons, we should be able to figure this out. Okay. So anyway, cool. But like I said, you know, we can take this wider and explain that a bunch of negative emotions aren't doing you any damage either. So that's fine. So we can all be comforted in our misery that it isn't actually doing damage. And if you're having a great time in life, you know, don't use that as a buffer zone to make a bunch of self-destructive decisions, but you think you're buffered against it because you're feeling so wonderful that it's not a problem to light up a cigarette again, because, you know, the wonderful endorphins that you're feeling from your new love affair are going to buffer you against the impact of the cigarettes. They will not buffer you. Okay. So you are a machine, everybody. All right. Great job, Nate.
Yeah. It's interesting because I guess in the case of our physical bodies, if you break a rib, for example, or break a bone, it'll actually heal back a little bit stronger than when it was originally.
Yeah.
So there's an example of doing the complete opposite. But when I was in sports, when I was younger, I would go to the doctor once in a while if I broke something, and that happened very often. But they said that, oh, you got to be careful, because if you don't take care of it, then it's gonna cause problems later on in your life. And so perhaps that's where the whole trauma, you know, thing that damages you came from. Maybe that myth came from there. Who knows? We'll never know. But I hear this all the time that,
Yeah. All right. Let's take some questions.
All right. Okay. So our first question has to do with this exact topic. Dr. Lyle, my question for you is pertaining to a problem I've been struggling to find a solution for over the past few years. I'm a 21-year-old mm-hmm. male and have been in two enjoyable relationships with women, each of which lasted mm-hmm. around 4 months and ended relatively happily. I'm very close mm-hmm. Friends with one of my former partners. If it is of mm-hmm. any relevance, one of the relationships ended on my own volition and the other did not. Though the sample mm-hmm. size is small, those were unquestionably the happiest periods of my life so far, and it wasn't until long after they had ended that I realized why that was the case. The feeling mm-hmm. that I was and still am craving was validation from another person. I suppose mm-hmm. I can boil it down to the idea that, quote, I really like this person because they're amazing and they really like me, so I must be doing something right. I suspect that the palpability of this feeling likely stems from having low self-esteem, though fortunately, it seems to have been growing over the years. The problem here is I don't want to need this feeling in order to be as happy as I can be. I think I very well could go the rest of my life giving into it, but I'd rather reach a point which I know I can live happily without seeking validation from others. It's partially for this reason that I've refrained from engaging in a romantic relationship over the past few years, as I figure I'm more likely to solve the problem when deprived of that form of validation. I've attempted to find solutions to this in a number of ways, including continually reminding myself the reasons why I like who I am and practicing mindful meditation, which I like to think has helped to some extent. I'd love to hear any advice you can offer on this issue.
This is a thing of beauty. All right, kid, here's the deal. You will be seeking validation from another person, and it will be the high point of your existence if you're for as long as you live. There's no such thing as not being the most exquisite thing that there is. Okay? So we can go talk to some yogi on a mountainside who says that it's not so, but they're bluffing. Your quote, low self-esteem, it isn't what's driving this need and the exhilaration that came from being, quote, validated. Let's translate the word validated into English that we can all understand. So what you are seeking is esteem signals that indicate that the other person finds you valuable enough to engage in sexual relationships with you as opposed to your competitors. So the quote validation is simply the sexual choice on the part of the females who are saying, given all of my options right now and all the options that I'm likely to have in the short-term future at least, you're the best option and you're above the bar. I'm not wild about most of my options. However, I'm actually very pleased with you as an option. So therefore, if you want to copulate, I'd be into it. Okay? Now,
so
your
romantic,
brain
Dr.
has... Well, that's why if you go to my door right now, there's a whole bunch of them lying around the block. All right. Just no end of my charm, mate.
I got to take some lessons because I don't have anybody wrapped around the block.
All right. So anyway, the deal is that the device inside your head that I call the esteem meter is built in that system in order to be sensitive to feedback signals from other people. It is essential that this is the epicenter of human life satisfaction, because the greatest statistical variance that's associated with your likelihood of survival or your likelihood of reproduction or both has to do with how valuable other people find you. how valuable they find you is not independent of their options. So you are simply a player in a marketplace. And so in this case, we're going to assume that if this was a very big high for this young man, that he found these two young women quite attractive. So therefore, they were another component to understand this particular individual's situation and maybe some of his puzzlement, is that another component of your mind is what we're going to call the self. So I've gone through this in other podcasts where you have three primary mechanisms inside your mind. You have an esteem meter, you have an internal audience, and you have what I call the self. So the self is a set of calibration equipment that that assesses your competitive standing in the world and assigns goals for you to pursue. For example, in this case, it's with respect to romance. So the two young ladies that he got involved with were two young ladies that his calibration system, as it analyzed his percentile rank in the competitive pool and analyzed their percentile rank in the competitive pool, it came up with a computation that said that these were both pretty exciting deals. So therefore, he pursued these deals, and when it turned out that he got positive esteem signals, accepting esteem signals from these young women, it was extremely exciting. That's how it's supposed to be. I want to translate this into a sports analogy. Suppose you're LeBron James and you've won three titles. This guy's won two titles in the dating so far, but LeBron's won three. And suppose that LeBron said, you know what it is that I seek? What is it I seek is to not really care what happens with respect to my career, whether I win or lose. That, you know, that and what other people think of me in terms of my abilities, I really don't care. That's what I seek. I seek not giving a damn about any of that. Oops. That doesn't make any sense at all. Okay. What that man is doing is he's seeking esteem from two parties. Number one, the outside world, as he advertises his fitness indicators as well as he possibly can, and also from his internal audience, who is driving him and coaching him to make the most of his abilities in order so that he can optimize his trading across the major domains of life. And therefore, if he can trade as well as he possibly can and it secures the finest possible relationships, then he will get happiness as a result of the feedback systems and the processes that take place within those relationships. Okay, so this young man asks very deep, interesting, intelligent questions. He's being sort of goaded and deluded by some new age philosophy away from reason. And no, you will never be in a situation where you don't care about the feedback from other people. You're designed by nature to care deeply about the feedback from other people. You're designed by nature to be exhilarated if you get positive feedback from someone that you consider to be outstanding. That's called falling in love. And there's no more exquisite experience on earth for a human being than that. Okay? So the desire to seek that and the exhilaration that comes with that does not stem from, quote, low self-esteem. You should be, unless you have had extraordinarily positive feedback every time you wink, I would expect you to have substantial insecurity. So let's suppose that an individual is a 70th percentile attractiveness individual. Then we know, let's suppose it's a male. So let's assume that we can we're seeing him as a heterosexual individual, and we're going to keep all psychological parameters constant. So now we're just talking about sheer physical attractiveness. We would expect that who he'd be most interested in would be people north of him, so that the more attractive they are, the more exciting it would get. Okay. The fact is that when approaching or interacting with people who would be above his percentile rank in a substantial way, i.e. more than 10% more attractive than he is, we would expect him to feel competitive stress. We would expect him to feel like he might not be enough. Okay? This is not, quote, low self-esteem. This is low self-confidence. This is not the action of the internal audience giving feedback to the self about its performance. This is the self calibrating data from the competitive realities that the individual is facing and causing low self-confidence, which causes him to tread carefully so as to not be embarrassed about reaching above his station and therefore looking like a fool. Okay? That's not low self-esteem. Yeah, this is an interesting confusion that people have. Low self-esteem comes from your internal audience observing your efforts and having those efforts be judged as deficient and thereby the performance of effort being, you know, disgusting and frustrating. So that will come about from a variety of motivations, ego trap being a major factor and other problems there, laziness. So low self-esteem is effectively a moral judgment. Low confidence has nothing to do with that. So you can expect, as a person that is not Brad Pitt or George Clooney, you can expect yourself to feel competitive stress in situations where you may be reaching above your percentile rank. And you can feel the insecurity that's associated with that. And so that is not, quote, low self-esteem. And you can expect that to be a recurrent theme throughout your lifetime. And and you're going to hopefully have long periods, maybe forever, where if you get lucky and you get a great situation with a great partner and you qualify for that person, that you are, you know, deeply happy and definitely in that situation and you don't wind up feeling those recurrent processes that go on if you're on the market. But if you are on the market and you are searching for mates, you can expect to have the situation come up that there's going to be times when you're going to be interested in other people, but they're not going to be interested in you. And the feeling of what he's calling low self-esteem, which is actually low esteem, the signaling that one gets from people that are fancier than us that indicates that they don't find us very interesting is not low self-esteem. That's low esteem. That's a negative esteem signal. And those don't feel good. And they're not the result of any childhood issue. This is the result of a naturally and appropriate built-in market sensing dynamic. And it's designed by nature to calibrate your actions with respect to the competitive opportunities in such a way as to optimize the utilization of your time and energy in the search for gene survival. So the search for gene survival, don't expect it to be pleasant. expect it to be a roller coaster. And it's more of a roller coaster in your youth because you're not that well calibrated. And so there's some surprises and hopes and devastations as you find out what your calibration score looks like. However, you'll always be searching through a mysterious haze as to exactly what your calibrations are, because the feedback, we don't actually carry around percentiles in our head specifically, and other people don't always agree about what our percentile is or us about them. So there's slop in the system, and therefore there's both hope and there's devastation.
That sounds like the nice first chapter of a romance novel written by Dr. Doug Lyle.
All right, let's go on. What else we have?
All right, we're going to take one question. We're going to do one question here, and then we're going to take our. We have a caller on hold right now, so caller, please hang tight for a second, and then we'll get to you in just a second. So, dear Dr. Lyle, my question here is more of a meta one, I suppose, and it is influenced by works like Darwinian Happiness by researcher Bjorn Grinde, I don't know. Mm-hmm. As is established in so many ways in the field of evolutionary psychology, we seem to suffer greatly from what is coined evolutionary mismatch. The current circumstances, be it environment, social structure, diet, exercise, we find ourselves in are vastly different from what our brain has been evolved to in almost the entire history of Homo sapiens. We are made to live our days in a tribe-like structure in a green environment, having access to a limited amount of extremely calorie-rich foods, etc. Yet we wonder why we don't become happy by doing our mindfulness meditation or whatever, all alone in a gray concrete building, mostly surrounded by people we barely or not at all know and trust, trying to digest way too much calorie-rich foods found in abundance in the 7-Eleven next door. So the question is, should all of our focus and efforts be directed towards fixing as many of these evolutionary mismatches as possible to recreate as good as possible the circumstances our brain has developed in, and thereby resolving so much of the mental and physical issues we have stemming from the absence of exactly that what we are meant to have?
Very good thinking. And the answer is yes. So that's a really good place for people to be focus their energies. So that's what this show is about. We're actually talking about that. I was not aware of the books that that he's talking about. So it's interesting that other people are discussing these same things finally. and that's good. Yeah, I'm sure my take on these things is somewhat different than some of theirs, but there's going to be considerable overlap, which is all good. So yeah, we've talked about on this show, ego trap. We've talked about pleasure trap. We talk about pseudo-esteem. We talk about behavior genetics and understanding that individuals are not changing, and therefore it's very useful to try to select out your own personal village. Obviously, as I spoke about this in the pleasure trap, that the modern world is a wonder. It's a two-edged sword. Every time that you see a benefit, there's a substantial possible cost that's associated with that advantage. It would be unwise to say that the modern world is a mess and that we're all miserable. That's not true. People are happier today than they've ever been. Okay, they are more satisfied, better fed, can see more of the world, better educated, etc. It's just better. And so people that lament the good old days when you essentially were in a little village of a bunch of starving, savages that were worried about the warfare of the tribal village next door and were, losing half their kids in the first year or two of life, et cetera, and worried about predators all the time, this is no grand way to live. So, however, it had some advantages that we don't have. You did have, among all, virtually everybody there, feelings of deep connection with other people. You survived or you either made it or didn't make it as a group. So you don't have that today. You can have people all in their own independent little apartment silos, doing work that isn't connected to any Stone Age money process at all. And so there's advantages to, and the way we evolved, there's advantages to simpler life that we left, and there's also grave disadvantages as well. So our job here is to, as intelligently as possible, take advantages of the advantages while we keep our eyes focused on the problems associated with the changes that have taken us away from our nature. So that's what this is about. And I'm just babbling because I could say more, but that's exactly what it is that I spend my life doing, is to instructing people as to where it is that their life is now veered away from their Stone Age nature, and that what their feeling centers are telling us is that something is out of balance. So our job is to use those feelings as a guidance system, just as a doctor does or a dentist does, asking where you're uncomfortable, that we use feelings as a guidance system to tell us where things are out of balance, and using the Stone Age brain as an understanding of how those value systems are built, and therefore what these feeling signals are attempting to generate and tell us, by actually having a heuristic that tells us how this thing is working. It's immensely valuable clinically, and it's also very valuable if it's not clinical, if you just read it in a book and follow some instructions. So this is the value of understanding, of self-understanding who it is that we are, the souped up, fabulous chimpanzee that is a human being.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lau. Well, let's take our caller.
All right.
All right. Marcus, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks so much. And
very good.
If I could flood your flood your circuits just a little bit.
Sure.
You know, Nate, I wanted to tell you, Nate, all of your hard work with the podcast. Nate, you're providing a great public service, and I know that all the fans of the show really appreciate all of your hard efforts and what you do. And Dr. Lyle, all of your teachings through your lectures and webinars and the podcast have made a big difference in my life. And I wanted to get the opportunity to thank you for that. Just to give you my story briefly, I've been dealing with a big weight issue, which caused, of course, a lot of serious health problems. I'm 5 feet, 8 inches tall. At my biggest point, I was 276 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I was wearing pants as a 52-inch waist. At that time, due to my horrible diet, I was shoveling in junk food with both hands. I had gallbladder removed, appendix, kidney stones, bladder stones. I had part of my colon removed due to diverticulitis, and I had a colostomy bag for 4 months, so I was in bad shape. And starting out with forks over knives and then trying to dig out information and finding your lectures and all the webinars that you did with Dr. McDougall's site and on YouTube and all that stuff, I have lost a little bit over 50 pounds. And I've kind of hit an equilibrium, and what I'm trying to do is up the exercise a little bit and look for the places in my diet where I can clean up and kind of tighten those things up. Because really, being honest, I was probably following the plant-based diet about 80% or so. Sometimes some weeks better, but mostly, around there, and on the weekends I would kind of get sidetracked. And really, I think my best success is during my work week, when I've got the structure of my work day. So I'm planning out what I'm going to eat during a day. And so I'm wondering if you would have any strategies to where I could, get over the hump of that equilibrium and tighten up things a little more, tighten up the diet, if that makes sense.
Oh, sure, it makes sense. All right. I'm chuckling because I do about 1,000 phone consultations a year, and your question is probably the question of about at least 150 of them, okay? So this is a common question, and it's a question that I had today. So what's the secret? Will everybody lean in like this is an E.F. Hutton commercial from the 1970s? So if you guys are probably too young to know what that is. All right.
I'm furiously Googling it right now.
Okay, good. All right. So what's the secret? Well, let's talk about a few little details here, Marcus. First of all, the reason why we do anything is because we're running a cost-benefit analysis. And so and the cost-benefit analysis is being done through, sort of a complex web of sensation, memory, opportunity, effort, et cetera. So it's a whole, set of parallel equations about different alternative courses of action that you could take and what would, what would be the best deal. And so before you knew the connection between diet and your health, there would be no way for you to know that, a potato with butter was going to be healthier for you than a steak you know, a steak with some, I don't know, a little rice on the side. So you wouldn't have known the difference. And so you got sick enough and got lucky, and you're smart enough and were motivated enough and you'd suffered enough through all the stuff that you've gone on that you decided to make a change. So you watch Forks Over Knives and you're thinking, seems halfway reasonable. And so you make some changes, and that's no small event that takes place. So you're down 50 pounds. That's no small victory. I would call that phase one. In other words, you've now experimented with these behavior changes, and you have now learned something profound. And that is that it really makes a big difference to your physical self. It makes a big difference what you eat. That's huge. Okay, so that's sort of phase one. Now you've kind of hit an equilibrium. Now let me ask you this: how's your health now? Are you in much pain? How are things going?
I just feel so much better. I've got type 2 diabetes, and you know, so I'm hoping to drop some more significant weight and you know, get rid of that or get it under control.
Okay.
But boy, I just feel so much better than I used to, for sure.
Yeah, you know what? You feel so much better that you almost don't have to bother anymore. So that's a problem. Okay. So the motivation, the cost benefit analysis is now changed, because the potential benefit for you before was enormous and immediate. It was all the pain and you know, debility that you were in. So now it turns out that you feel you've made significant changes. You've had a major change in your morphology. Okay, to drop 50 pounds is phenomenal. And so and you feel much better. So now we sit at a different place with respect to your motivation. How old are you, Marcus?
50.
50, okay. So any smoking history?
No.
Okay, no smoking. Good, okay. So no known existing cardiac pathology? So no stents in there, no heart attacks, et cetera?
Correct, yeah, none of that.
Okay. So things are looking pretty good. If we were to guess how long you were going to live right now, we would guess about 30 years, even with your type 2 diabetes, okay? So, and that's, you know, given how well it is that you feel, that's kind of what your intuition is telling you. Your intuition is kind of telling you, you know what, Marcus, I think we're out of the woods. Okay. Now, so, are you getting any, peripheral neuropathy in your feet, hands, anything like that?
Yeah, a little bit in my feet.
Got it. A little bit in your feet. Okay. So that's good. So now instead of being one of those savages back in the Stone Age with some process going on that they couldn't possibly understand and blamed on the gods, we now have a process that we know exactly what's going on. Okay. We know that you're in trouble, that there's going to be a creeping neuropathy that's going to take place as long as we you know, have diabetes. And so things are so this far out of balance. So things aren't good enough in order to stop a creeping pathological condition. Okay. So
right.
However, it's not a runaway train. So here you are, you're kind of like a dog on a porch laying on a little nail. It's like, it's not that bad.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not sure you really want to get up. And it's kind of pretty comfortable there. There's a nice breeze. Everything's fine. So I don't really mind laying on this nail because it's not too much of a nail and it's not causing me too much discomfort. So that's where we are. You've made a big positive change, and now you're sort of thinking, well, gee, you know, how come it stopped? Sort of how come this isn't enough? And sort of, you know, kind of what you're doing that is contributing to the continuing problem. And yet you don't really have that much motivation to not do it. Okay?
Right.
So that's our problem. Our problem is that you're not that motivated. You're not that scared. The process that you're in now is a very slow-moving train. So we could just wait a little while until they start talking about cutting off your big toe. Okay? then maybe we'll get motivated. All right? So what I'm going to want to try to do is I'm going to try to get you to look at the problem from a slightly different angle. The right now, the motivation is, let me ask you something else, just a little sideshow. How do you feel about the way you look now?
Well, I look better. I've got loose skin, which is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of gross.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I'm down to like, you know, 12 inches in my waist. So,
right.
You know, I feel better about that. And,
right.
So,
yeah. Is the loose skin, do you have a partner? Do you have, or are you sort of sitting on the sidelines because of the loose skin and the weight and all these issues, or what's your situation?
I'm married.
You're married.
Yeah, very lucky. Yeah, very lucky in that respect. She's
very lucky.
Married to a very sweet girl.
Got it. Okay. So, how do you feel? Do you feel embarrassed about the hanging skin?
You know, not in front of her. I mean, I'm, you know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to go out to the pool.
Right.
You know,
right.
But.
So you feel accepted there as far as that goes from your primary partner. So that's pretty
right.
good. So this is right. So we're and that's a little side issue. Does it bother you, for example, if you were to lose another 50 pounds, we're going to have more skin problems? Is that sort of lurking in the back of your mind as a challenge or a problem?
You know, my thought is if I could, you know, really get the more weight off, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, if need be, I would investigate, you know, surgery to get some of the loose removed.
Okay. All right. So that's sort of, sometimes people get themselves stopped because they don't want to face, you know, more of that problem. So I was just checking there if there was a little countervailing force that was kind of adding to the resistance to doing a better job. Okay.
Right.
So what I would say is that anybody that was ever 5'8" and 276 pounds has very thick genes. Okay. So your genes, the fact that, you know, most people that were eating the way you were eating would have been 5'8" and 200 pounds. You know, that's kind of what they would have been, maybe 210. But the fact that you got to 276 just tells me you come from a family that has, you know, sort of burly genes on the males or curvy genes on the females. In other words, that's just how you're essentially built genetically. Okay.
Right.
So what that means is that you've been doing what I would, you know, you went from doing standard, you know, the standard American does about a, what I consider like about a D when it comes to their diet. The way I curve my particular class is some mongrel between, you know, what you should do versus what people actually do, et cetera. So in theory, you would have been a C, but the truth is that the whole damn society gets downgraded. So we're going to give you a D for what you used to do. And given a D, you wound up with worse than D, like a D minus results. Okay. Cause of your genes. Now you've been doing what I would consider B or even B plus work, probably B work, some of the cheating you're doing enough of it. So you're doing B work, and what we wound up with is sort of C, C minus results. Okay? That's the fact that your genes are what they are. Those we can't control. So that means that, and unfortunately, because of that, we're winding up with a creeping type 2 diabetes problem that at age 50 is not swallowing your function yet, but you're heading into trouble. Okay. So what I would tell you is that to be reasonable, you actually need to do more like B plus A minus work. If you do B plus A minus work, then we're going to start getting a C plus or a B minus in health, which means we're going to start heading down into, you know, 200, 190 pounds, something like that, and we'll arrest the diabetes. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's you know, that's this is what I would call phase two. Phase three is for the hyper-conscientious nutcases, like my friend Chef AJ, who just puts the floor, you know, puts the gas to the floorboard and just goes as fast as the car will go. Okay?
Yeah.
So we don't know, you know, you don't talk that into anybody. That's just in there. And so there's people that just have that in them to do. I don't, and maybe you don't either. You sound a little more naturally stable. And so therefore, I don't know that we're ever going to turn you into a hyper-conscientious nutcase. All right? But we do reasonably need to – just a nut. That's all.
Just a nut.
So what we need to do is we need to move you from being sort of the B player you are up to a B plus A minus player. Okay? It's really what we need to do. And the place where we're going to look at this is not aiming at beautiful results, because your results are actually got you relaxed anyway. But there's a process that's going on that's a little bit disturbing. And that process is your internal audience. So your internal audience was fine with you suddenly doing B work, which relative to everybody else in your experience was like the top student in the class. Okay. Your B work as a veggie vegan, you know, human, your B work is better than anybody else you saw. Much more conscientious, much more health conscious, much more knowledgeable, and much more concerned. Okay. Nobody else worries about dripping, you know, I don't know, melted cheese on their pastrami sandwich at lunch with a Coca-Cola. What's the problem? Okay. But you did. So you drank the Kool-Aid, got educated, and then found out that it was true, as all these things about your health and your body improved dramatically. Okay. Now, however, we've kind of ended that. We now know you ran the experiment. You used your intelligence and your diligence to have major successes. But now what we can see is that you're kind of doing a half-assed job.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And you know you're doing a half-assed job. So your internal audience is watching you do a half-assed job. And it's telling you, hey, Marcus, you're kind of doing a half-assed job. Okay. Now, you're not doing a terrible job. You know, you're not doing a terrible job. You're doing a half-assed, okay, decent job, but you're not doing a really good job. And so what I want you to pay attention to, and this is a very unsexy secret. It's the most important secret that there is in psychology, but it is not sexy. So people ask me 150 times a year this question: what's the secret? What's the trick? How can I get myself on track? I just can't seem to get myself motivated, blah, 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 blah. Okay? Hear it all the time. And the reason why you did a pretty good job is you were in serious pain and in serious trouble, and you found the solution and you executed on it and you got out of serious trouble. That's fabulous. Okay? But now you're doing a half-assed job. And with you doing a half-assed job, i.e. B work, doing B work is getting you C-minus type of results because of your genes. Okay? So we need to raise the bar to B plus A minus. And when we do that, we'll raise your results up to B. We'll get rid of the diabetes. You'll drop 30 pounds, maybe 40 pounds. You know, things are going to be better and you have a way brighter future in front of you. But the way we're going to do it is not through some magic motivation of promising you a better future, because your present isn't that bad. Okay? What we're going to do is we want to look inside you and get you educated as to what to watch for, the real value of doing a better job. The real value of doing a better job is when your internal audience watches you execute on a very good long-term plan with good fundamentals. As it watches you, it starts to pat you on the back. And it says, hey, Marcus, you're not doing a half-assed job. You're doing better than a half-assed job. Good job. Okay? it's subtle and it's quiet, but the slightly negative feedback that you are now getting from your internal audience will quiet down. Now, your internal audience is still, unfortunately, giving you a little bit of positive feedback just from having done what you've done. You're still in the glow of that, but it's wearing off, okay? And now you're facing a new reality now that you're at equilibrium and we're still, you know, we still got some significant trouble. The internal audience is now going to start demanding that you step up your game, okay? Time to quit doing B work. It's time to start, you know, raising your grade point average. We need to go from a 3.0 to a 3.5. That's what we need to do, okay? So what I'm going to recommend that you do is that you pay attention to your internal audience and notice that, for example, if sometime in the next month you decide to pin your ears back and do a really good job for about 5 to 7 days in a row, just do an exceptionally good job. And we're not tricking you into doing this long term. What we're doing is we're running an experiment on your own nervous system so that you can actually make an intelligent decision in your future about how you should be motivated to do what. Okay? So let's suppose that you were a student that was pretty smart in some class and you weren't doing too well, and then a fellow student came along and said, listen, you're not understanding. You need to buy another textbook and do problems out of the other textbook, and that gives you more practice. And then when you get more practice, you can do a lot better. Suppose you did that and you went from being a B-minus student to an A student. Do you think it might motivate you in the future to do that again for another class? I think it would.
Certainly. Right.
Okay. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're going to try to educate you into how it is that, you know, what it feels like, and watch carefully your psychological dynamics, that when you pin your ears back and do an excellent job, I want you to see what that feels like inside. Forget about the physical part because you feel pretty good physically. Pay attention to the emotional part, that your internal audience will say, hey, this is pretty damn good what you're doing. Okay. That's the feeling. We want to see that that feeling is not an accident. That feeling is what we're going to call pride. Okay. Pride only comes from that process. It comes from you knowing that you diligently did an excellent job. That could be cleaning out the closet, running a multinational corporation, or sticking to your diet for a week and doing a really good job. Pride is the internal audience saying, well done. I appreciate your effort. Good job. Okay? I want you to feel that and recognize incredibly that that is totally under your control. Pop psychology thinks it's under your control from affirmations. So a young man in the earlier question does his affirmations and tries to say positive things or whatever the hell it is. And of course, nothing like that ever works. It's a completely useless process. What works, what you feel about yourself arises from the internal audience's observation of your efforts. That is where it comes from. And if you do a good job, it doesn't matter if you stare in the mirror and say, you're an idiot and you're a moron and you're screwing everything up. If you're not an idiot and not a moron and you are not screwing everything up, your internal audience just laughs at this whole thing. It's like ludicrous. Okay? And if you do a mediocre job and stare in the mirror and say, you're doing fantastic, you're beautiful, you're handsome, you're brilliant, and I love you, okay? It's not going to change one bit about how you feel about yourself. Your internal audience is a pitiless judge as it watches what it is that you do and gives you feedback. It's a shadow coach, and it's telling you the truth. So what I want you to do is focus on watching how that mechanism works, so that when you do an excellent job sometime in the next month and you decide, okay, I believe I'm going to start this week and I'm going to do this thing. By 4 or 5 days into this thing, you know, 6, 7 days, your internal audience will start to tell you, well done, Marcus. Okay? And then you will know there's the feeling. There's only one way to get it, and we can always get it back. And it's a very interesting feeling and a very worthwhile feeling, okay? That's the feeling that I want you to be returning to for the rest of your life. You're going to get drawn back into little versions of the pleasure trap. You're not going to do things perfectly. You will not set up a perfect score like Chef AJ or Alan Goldhammer or any of these other hyper conscientious, you know, health nuts. You're not going to do that. That's fine. But what I want you to do is to recurrently seek that feeling of internal excellence, where you repetitively go on streaks, where you do a very good job. Okay. And if you do that, we're not doing it just for the health benefits, because we're not that scared. We're doing it for the feeling of feeling really good about ourselves. That's what will draw you back and recurrently try to do the best. That's the best motive I know for getting on a healthier track and staying on there a high percentage of the time. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, I really appreciate
all right.
that.
This was a, I really appreciate you coming on and asking this question. This is a super valuable question for so many people. And so, you know, your story is an inspiring one, and it parallels many people that have walked this walk and done a good job and had significant positive benefits, but then got stalled as they got better. And they got sort of good enough, and they got out of the acute distress, and now they're kind of in an equilibrium, and they're a little bit out of steam. There's no more wind in their sails, okay? And so this is how we try to discover how to get some control over the wind. It's through our sensitivity to the self-esteem mechanism and essentially getting a little bit addicted, at least in stretches, to that feeling, that really wonderful internal moral judgment that our self-esteem mechanism gives to us when we've done a really good job. Okay?
Marcus, thank you very, very much for the phone call and the wonderful question. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Hey, I really appreciate you taking all that time with me, and I don't know what to say. I just appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Marcus. That's why we're here. Thanks for calling.
Sure.
All right. Dr. Lyle, we'll end there. Thank you very much. What a wonderful answer. I think a lot of people wanted to hear something like this, myself included.
Good. Terrific. All right, Nathan, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.